Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate tonight.
And I'm here on time.
Yay!
I want that to be on the record. Early, 30 seconds, thank you.
I know, no heart failure today. That's awesome.
Yeah.
But it's Thursday, October 23rd, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and we're so happy if you're listening with us live tonight. I want to go ahead and give the call-in number right off the bat. We haven't had callers the last few weeks, but it's 1-718-766-4332. Again, it's 1-718-766-4332. And if you have an option to call from a phone that it's not going to cost you the long-distance fee, I would highly recommend that. Tonight, I'm so excited about the show. We're going to finish talking about what we started last week or the past couple of weeks about sensory processing disorder in toddlers and young preschoolers. Tonight, we're going to talk about how sensory disorders might affect a child's play. And then beyond that, we're going to talk about red flags that really warrant a referral for early intervention services for speech, developmental, physical, or occupational therapy. And again, Kate and I are going to have to go really fast to get through this whole list, and that might be hard for us because we're so darn chatty about this stuff. We've already probably talked, an hour and a half about this stuff already today. So just kind of between the kids that we saw. So maybe.
So we know there are moms and dads out there who have been told or may suspect that their kids have sensory issues. And if you would prefer to remain anonymous when you call in, that's fine with us. Just say,
sure.
Hi, I'm calling about my child, and make up a name. You don't need to give any identifying information. But so often, Laura, I mean, such a high percentage of my caseload, they have, you know, either the occupational therapist or the initial therapist who happened to go in and do the initial assessment says, I think there might be some sensory issues, or maybe it's something that comes up over, you know, a little bit of time. But it's such a common thing nowadays, and
yeah.
I just love having feedback from families and or therapists. So if you're out there listening, don't be shy.
Call us. Okay, let's get started with where we left off last week. Remember, last week we talked about how a child's social skills and how his, what was that first area before social skills? I can't remember, and I have already put that sheet away.
Are you sure we did social and then emotional?
Social and emotional skills. How those red flags or how those behaviors, how quirky little things might actually be attributed to a sensory processing disorder. And tonight we're going to continue with that by looking at play skills. And we all know, if you've listened to the show, that play is near and dear to our hearts. Since as pediatric therapists, that's what we do. That's how we teach toddlers who are having developmental delays, either with language or cognitive skills, even with motor skills. I think I'm getting a little beep in. I think I forgot to turn off caller ID. Sorry about that. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, you beeped out for a minute.
Okay.
But you're back.
Okay. All right, so we're going to talk about how play skills might be affected by sensory issues. So the first one is that they may have difficulty with imitative play, and that would be any kid over 10 months that really can't imitate what you're doing. And so if you have a 12-month-old that is not copying you when you clap your hands and say, yay, that's a red flag for you. That's indicating that his motor skills or even maybe his cognitive skills are delayed so that he can't copy that action that you're doing. Some other kinds of imitative play might be when you cover your eyes to play peekaboo. If you have a 24-month-old who won't copy that from you, that's a real red flag. And again, that tells you that he's having difficulty with either the motor part or the cognitive part. He doesn't know what you're doing, or even the social part. He's not interacting with you. That's a red flag that something's going on there that you need to have checked out. Kate, you want to do the next one?
Sure. The next point is you have a child who may wander aimlessly without purposeful play or exploration over 15 months. And I certainly see a fair number of these kids. They just kind of wander around the room, maybe touch this, pick that up, A lot of those kids tend to be the button pushers that we're so
right.
fond of, Laura. You know, they have a broom full or a toy chest full of bells and whistle toys. And those, if you've ever listened to anything we've said, you know we don't love those toys.
Ditch them. Yeah.
Take the batteries out. Give them to the Goodwill. Let somebody else use them. And, you know, young kids do tend to like those toys, and I'm not saying they're inherently bad, but if that's your child's idea of play beyond 12 to 15 months, if they're just kind of going around, pushing the buttons, activating the lights and sounds, that's a really fairly immature form of play, and you should
right.
be looking for something beyond that.
Over age 15 months.
Right, more functional
yeah.
play.
Right.
So, or some kids don't even do that, really. It just may be they're just kind of wandering around aimlessly, touching things, maybe pick up a ball for a second, toss it down, then they walk over to something else, and they pick that up. And there's just really no sitting and attending and actually playing with something. I always call it functional play. Laura and I love our ball toys, any variety of ball toys. You know, you put the ball in the hole and you hit it and it goes down the ramp and then you get the ball and you put it back in the hole. And they don't do that. You know, they don't seem to understand, or perhaps it's that they have tactile defensiveness and they don't like the feel of that ball in their hand. I mean, we don't go in knowing, gee, what's at the root of this issue. We
right.
just know if it's they're 15 months or older and they're not doing that and they've been shown, you know, we always start out by kind of helping them do it if they're not doing it. But if they've been helped or they've been shown a number of times and they're not doing it, that would certainly be a red flag for something's not quite right here. He should be
right.
understanding this. He should be doing this. So.
Age-appropriate, fun, kind of play with a toy. And you need to go ahead and get a referral and get that checked out. What you just said, Liz.
Laura, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're making funny noises. Your voice is cutting in and out.
It's fine. Okay, you talk about the next one, and I'm going to call in on another line.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, that's okay. I'm so glad you told me. Okay, thanks.
Okay. The next one is needs adult guidance to play, difficulty playing independently. And that's beyond 18 months. And I certainly see a lot of these kids, and I have it called to my attention a lot because as I see a child and they get to know me and know my routines and what I do, they become pretty good at playing with me. And the parents will say, well, she plays with you great, but really, unless somebody's playing with her, she doesn't really play very well. And I think that tends to be, Laura may correct me when she comes back here, but that tends to be those kids who are seeking a whole lot of sensory feedback and left to their own devices. They really don't sit, and it's not the sit and play for any length of time, and I don't mean 2 hours. I mean 5 to 10 minutes, even if they like something. You know, you see they light up, they show an interest, they do it 1 minute, boom, they're on to the next thing. And I think that's probably they need a whole lot of feedback in their little sensory systems, and if they're not getting it by having somebody play with them and make it more kind of enticing and exciting and giving them more sensory stimulation, then they're moving on. You know, they don't sit and attend for any length of time. And I hear that a lot, and I suspect Laura does too, but that's kind of a common kind of red flag. You know, he'll do it with me. Yeah, but not by himself. So.
And that leads to the next one, which is kind of the opposite problem. A kid who might participate in repetitive play for hours, totally isolated, and by repetitive play we mean that they might just not really play with stuff. They just want to line it up. What I see all the time are kids that maybe little boys who are two and who are choo-choo train obsessed, and they don't really hook them together and make them go around the track or put them in and out of the little station. All they want to do is line them up. And if you make one little push one little car and make that line mess it up a little bit, they tend to have a tantrum over that. So they're really more excited about the organizational aspects of play than really using the toy appropriately.
Yeah, it brings to mind the little boys I've had. And I'm not sure I've ever in 10 years had a girl who was fixated on this, but the little boys who lay on the floor on their bellies and put the car down on the floor or the choo-choo or whatever other vehicle with wheels there might be, and they have their head right down on the floor with their head tilted, and they're rolling back and forth and back and forth. And really, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, sometimes parents don't even realize that's a problem.
Right.
They just say, he only likes wheels, or boy, he really is going to be a mechanic when he grows up because he's just so interested in those wheels and how that works. Mm-hmm. And I have to gently say, no, this is a problem. He's really getting kind of a visual stimulatory feedback from watching those wheels spin, and that's not normal. That's not what we want to see with play by this age.
Right.
You know, watching things spin, well, let me just say this point, and then we'll shut up and let you do your thing. But, you know, watching things spin, that's great for six-month-olds and eight-month-olds because we want them to be interested in their environments and we want to see that. But if you are over, what's that guideline, 18 months or so and are still fascinated by that kind of play, that lets us know that developmentally you're not moving along like we want to see you move along.
Yeah, I see that one as a real big red flag. And I was just going to give a cautionary note about, we don't mean for a minute. We don't mean for even a couple minutes. We don't mean they just got it and, boy, they're interested in all the ways they can use it. We mean that's really what they pretty much do with a given toy. And
that you might see it, you know, 50 times in a day rather than, you know, for 30 seconds when they're playing.
Yeah, and I think also there are certainly some carryover or connection between those kids who like to lay and watch the wheels and kids who do tend to spin objects. And I mean, they spin lots of things. Anything they think they can spin, you give them a puzzle piece and they spin it. You give them a cup and they spin it. That's the fascination, those things going round and round and round. And what was my other thing, Miss Laura?
I think about kids, we'll come back to that if you think about it in a second, but other kids who might be so fascinated with blocks that they just want to stack them, or flick them around in their hands to look at how the edges look at different angles. You know, again, that would be an example of repetitive play and not functional play. It might also be a kid who wants to watch the same movie over and over. And again, this isn't the kind of kid that would just have a favorite movie that might ask to watch it, you know, once or twice in any given day or even several times a week. This is a kid who goes ballistic when you try not to put the same video in over, 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 and over. Or a mom might say to me, I can't get him to calm down. The only thing that'll calm him down is watching Blue's Clues or watching whatever, or a kid who never...
Let's go on and say it. Baby Einstein.
Yeah. Which, in my opinion, you know, you have to wonder, I'm not even going to go there. I'm not going to call it what we call it off the air. I might get sued. I'm not even going to go there.
Yeah, I wouldn't. But we, you know, the same thing over and over and over. And I recall what I was going to say about that, watching the thing spin or watching the wheels go round and round as they, you know, get level with the wheels. You hinted at this, Laura, that if you disrupt that play, 9 times out of 10, they're mad. You know, it is really a fixation for them. We're not talking just a mild, oh, that's neat, and they'll happily move on. I mean, that's what they intend to do. And if you disrupt it, you're going to have a fit on your hands, or they're going to throw it at you, or...
And if you're a parent listening to this and are getting a sinking feeling in your stomach right now and thinking, oh, no, then that would indicate to me that you know in your heart of hearts that there's a problem. And you need to listen to that voice and go ahead and have your child evaluate it. Because, again, we're not talking about just, oh, the typical toddler who, you know, wants to do his favorite things. We're talking when it really kind of becomes almost an obsession, and they get a little jolt from lining up or stacking up or, again, watching the same movie repetitively. If you're feeling like, oh, no, that I haven't really thought about that as a problem in my kid, then there probably is an issue that you need to go ahead and get checked out by a professional.
Right. And in my mind, I really kind of put those repetitive or obsessive button pushers in the same category. If that's really, after 18 months, if their idea of play or what they engage in and you refer to as play is push the button, you know, just sometimes they'll even have other things that it's supposed to do, but they really don't do the other things. It's just push the button. And when you ask mom, well, what does she like to play with? And everything that 18-month or 24-month-old child likes to play with has lights, whistles, and buttons, you know, that's probably, again, 9 months, 10 months, 12 months, not an issue probably, but beyond 18 months, if that's everything your child likes, has lights and a button, to me that's a big problem.
Right,
you know,
and sometimes parents really get caught up in, well, the toy's educational.
Mm-hmm.
It has ABCs. It has colors. You know, but again, analyze what your kid's doing with that. And, you know, one more time I'll say that, you know, no kid at two really should be obsessed with letters or, you know, at two we do want kids to be learning colors. But, again, to have that obsession with those letters and to really only want to do that kind of play versus all kinds of pretend play really lets you know that there may be a little red flag there.
Or even just basic functional play. Yeah, and a lot, I mean, I've never, honestly, I can't recall a time when I was evaluating or working with a child who was so into those toys, they were the button pushers, you know, set the lights off, make the music go. If you turn around and say, well, where's the A or what's red or show me blue, they don't know it. You know, they really aren't learning it. They're just activating the toy.
Well,
and you're right. Another soapbox. We don't like those toys either.
Yeah. Throw those out too. And again, the toy manufacturers have really done such a disservice to parents because they get you thinking that it's appropriate to be working on ABCs with a kid who's 14 months old or even 24 months old. If you are spending most of your learning time or your playing time with your kid working on that, please read my website.
Yeah.
And go under the section that talks about toys and get some different ideas for some different play. Because kids, that learning letters and learning numbers and those things, those are preschool activities, and your child needs to have so many other play skills in his repertoire and be developing in so many other ways. You know, there's nothing on a developmental checklist before about five that talks about identifying letters and numbers. You know, and again, all the major toy manufacturers really know that parents like to teach that, and have made so many of those toys, which are just totally, in my opinion, inappropriate for children that are infants and toddlers and when we're hyper-focused on those darn ABCs and 1, 2, 3s.
Right, and I hear that a lot. I was at Toys R Us today, and a mom was buying this electronic toy for her baby. It was all I could do to say, don't get that. Put that back. I don't like that toy.
Wait.
Yeah, I bit my tongue, believe it or not. But, yeah, it is a big push. This is educational, and it's always going to have colors, numbers, and letters.
Well, and, again, I'll go back to the example I use all the time. If your kid can't say bye-bye or ask for milk or say shoes, please don't worry about the ABCs.
Right.
Or don't try to teach him colors. You know,
even beyond that, if he doesn't know, if you say get your shoe and he doesn't even act like he knows what a shoe is, you're going to teach him S? You know, I mean, it really
it makes
is
no
that.
Sense.
Right. It just bothers us because we care. We care.
And
we
see it all the time by well-meaning parents. And
right.
Again,
parents
so
who think they're teaching.
Yeah, and they just don't understand that there's a whole lot that's going to go into their learning before you need to get to the alphabet and to numbers. All right, so do you have any more parting comments about play? Because I want us to move on. I want us to be sure that we get to talk about all these other red flags.
I guess my only parting comment, this is, you know, I use this as my weekly soapbox to get to say the things I want to say to other people, but I don't get to. I personally think that play is hugely important, not only for typical development of children, but as an indicator of what may or may not be going on with young children. And I think it's often overlooked by parents and even professionals to a large degree.
Yeah.
I wish that people realized that it is really the best way to kind of look at, gee, what, how is he doing? What does she know? You know, you can look at pretty much all areas of development as you look at a child's play and engage a child in play. And as a developmental therapist or interventionist in this state, that's certainly a big, and Laura's a huge player, much bigger player than most speech therapists, but we're definitely on the same page on that. But rarely do I hear parents say, or do they initially state when they decide to seek early intervention for their child, he just really doesn't play with things, or he has a strange way of playing, or he, we talk a lot about the young kids, 12 months to 2 years old, a lot of times the initial concern is walking, and beyond that, 18 months beyond, especially that two-year-old milestone, big year, parents worry about talking. And very often, not always, certainly there are kids who are not talking who are great players. They do everything the way we'd like them to do it. But then there are a lot who really aren't playing either, and that just goes completely unrecognized by a lot of people, and a lot of times even professionals. So that's all I want to say about it. Don't underestimate it.
Yeah, and you were so right to say every kind of developmental skill that we need to see with a kid, we can observe through play. We don't have to do a whole lot of fancy schmancy setting up different activities or, you know, from a speech therapist perspective, flipping the darn flashcards or that, you know, PLF4 manual. Really, a great pediatric therapist should be able to observe a kid's play with the kid, and elicit every developmental skill that they would want to see and get a really almost a better picture of where a kid is functioning through play than with even a standardized measure. And that's my plug for that for the day.
Well, I'm right there with you. And it does, I think it is kind of overlooked a lot of times. Parents just say, oh, yeah, he plays, he pushes those buttons, or he pushes, rolls that car. And, you know, they don't realize that, gee, that is really how children learn, and that probably is the biggest reflection of what they understand and what they recognize and are able to do in a very appropriate way, or inappropriate as the case may be. But anyway, I'll leave that one alone, but just don't forget how important it is.
And you've heard that saying, play is a child's work. So it really is how we assess how they're developing through their play. Okay, that's that. We're moving on from there. The next big thing that we wanted to talk about would be how sensory processing disorders could affect a kid's ability to self-regulate. And when I think of regulation, I always think it means kind of being on even keel. No matter what happens, no matter what routine changes, no matter where you are, a toddler's ability to self-regulate is hugely important. And again, I'm not talking about kids who have an occasional outburst, because that's the hallmark of being a toddler. You know, they don't call it terrible twos for nothing. But we're going to talk about extremes now. Kids who really have difficulty with activities of daily living or things that like sleeping, eating, those kinds of things. So the first indication that self-regulation might be an issue for your child are kids who are excessively irritable or fussy as infants and then on into toddlers. I've had kids, Kate, and I know you do too, and I'm thinking of one little guy on my caseload right now. As soon as he's excited to see me and he's waiting for me at the door and I get in, and then as soon as he gets over kind of the initial buzz of me being there and he knows what we're going to do, he does kind of go into a little funk with and really whiny and fussy and irritable. And his mom will say, oh, he's like this, you know, if he's up 18 hours, this is how he is 17 hours of the day. And that's not typical development. We do not want to see kids who are excessively upset or even just kind of that mild irritation all day long. That indicates that there's something else going on, and that there's probably some underlying problem, or that the adult is not being fun enough. And let me tell you, when I'm there with this kid, I am doing backflips, trying to pump it up, and get it more and more fun for this kid to get him to interact. And he's kind of a challenge. And his mom says all the time, I don't understand. I don't know why he's being this way. And we have to constantly talk about his ability to regulate and kind of keep his mood and even keel. You want to do the next one?
Okay. Can't calm or soothe self through pacifier, comfort object, or caregiver. Go ahead.
Again, I think about this little guy. He is okay, sort of, if the passy is in his mouth, and he's getting, he's 2.5 already. And so he should, you know, if he were a great self-regulator, he really wouldn't need the passy as much as he does. He really does kind of take it and calm down. And that usually is a lot of the reason why he's upset at the very beginning, because, you know, he's gotten excited and mom has tried to take the passy and hide it when I'm coming in the door, so it's not kind of a fight for him there. And I don't even care if he has the pacifier some of the time when I'm there, because he does need it to regulate. But this would be a kid who you never seem to be able to make happy. And have you had experience with those kinds of kids, Kate?
Oh, I think we all have, a time or two, yes. And like you said, even though you know they're giving you some indication that they're happier there and they want to, you know, play with you, it's still really hard for them.
They can't stay engaged and happy for a long time. And again, despite an adult's best effort, you can't just kind of keep them in that everything's okay spot. So, again, that tells you, you know, and some parents will say, oh, he's just moody, or, oh, he didn't get enough sleep, or, oh, he got, this mom always says, got mags for the pacifier. Yes, that's true, but the bottom line of that is that he has a lot of difficulty learning how to self-regulate and how to kind of move himself from one thing to another without it being a major ordeal. The next one is, the next problem with self-regulation that I've already sort of talked about is sleeping. These would be the kids who have great difficulty going to sleep. Either you might have to do like a whole hour bedtime routine. You've got to rub their back and the pillows have to be just right, and you may have to stand there with them to fall asleep. Or as a baby, it might be a kid who absolutely could not fall asleep unless the parent drove them around the block. And anytime I've done an assessment, a parent told me that, you know, the only time he falls asleep is if I rock him for 45 minutes, or his dad has to take him out every night and let him fall asleep in the stroller. That's not typical. Those aren't typical sleeping patterns. And that lets you know, again, that your child has difficulty self-regulating. That's not what we want to see as an infant or as a toddler.
The flip side of that can also be true. Not only can they be, and they're not necessarily, one child would have both, but sometimes they do. Not only are they hard to get to go to sleep, sometimes they're really hard to wake up, too. You know, they almost never wake up that they aren't whining and crying and fussy and demanding and, you know, just really miserable little guys or girls. But, again, it's just they don't really, for whatever reason, can't really get their little motors running without being basically pretty uncomfortable. And so mom knows, ooh, I better get him up a lot earlier than I need to go, because it's a process and it's always kind of painful for the child.
Yeah, and I've got to have the milk ready and the sippy cup, and he's going to fall apart if I don't have the sippy cup right there ready when he has to wake up. Or it's the mom who can't let the phone can't ring. She's got to totally unplug the phone and put a big sign on the door, you know, so that the nap isn't interrupted. You know, they can't, they don't wake up easily from a surprise, or even when they're waking up on their own, they seem distressed.
Yeah, I've had a number of parents tell me, oh, if he doesn't get to watch fill-in-the-blank show for at least a half an hour, he is just miserable all day long.
Yeah, the rest of the day. Yeah,
and that's the process, isn't it?
And that's a big red flag. And see, some parents don't look at it like that. They just have modified the environment so much
right. That
they don't even realize that that's a problem. Sometimes, you know, I'll sit in that first initial meeting with a parent, you know, it might even be after the assessment, and we're kind of going through, you know, it, by federal law and early intervention programs all through the United States, we have this document called an IFSP, or Individualized Family Service Plan. And part of that is that we talk about the routines of the day. When a mom is sitting there talking about, you know, all the lengths that she has to go through to help this kid make it through the day, you know, by the time that she's telling you, again, about the whole hour-long go-to-sleep routine and then the hour-long wake-up routine, you know, some therapists, and sometimes it's me, sometimes it's the OT, sometimes it's the service coordinator, somebody will say, let's talk about that. You realize that this is not normal. And sometimes we don't do it during that first meeting because we think a parent might be overwhelmed about that. But, you know, even a couple sessions down the road, when that comes up again, you know, we'll have to have a conversation about that and say, you know, that isn't normal, and this really indicates blah, 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 you know, whatever we think that might be. So, again, those routines that we do for our kids to be nurturing, sometimes moms don't even realize how much they've modified things so that their toddlers can get through the day. And they wouldn't think about these issues as being a sensory processing disorder, but really that's often the underlying cause. And those kinds of things really don't happen with neglectful or, for lack of a better word, bad mothers. It's nurturing mothers that get sucked into all that. And again, sometimes they don't even realize that that's an issue until somebody else brings that up. Sometimes it's mother-in-law, it's grandma, who's saying, you ought to be able to put that kid to bed without all that.
Mm-hmm. Does it always take you an hour and a half to get him to go to sleep? Yes. You know,
Yeah. Every
night it's that long.
Yeah. We have a little guy on our caseloads right now that we share, Kate, that I know who you know who I'm talking about. But he's better about going to bed now. But before, remember, he was staying up till 1:30 or 2 every morning because Wubsy came on at 12:30. And we just both looked at each other, you know, the last meeting that we did, and I think you referred me in on this kid, so you got him first, but, you know, you really talked about that. Okay, mom's name, that's not normal. Having your 2-year-old stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning, that's not normal. So, again, sometimes parents don't even recognize, you know, what modifications they've made that, and usually it is because of some reason in the that situation I'm talking about, that I guess that mom's motor runs, you know, that's her clock, too, to stay up really late and sleep really late. But, again, in your average family, that's not going to work, having a 2-year-old stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning every night of the week.
Right. Sometimes it can be. I think parents don't always, they're not necessarily proactive about setting the routine for the child, and it can be, you know, kind of a gray area. Well, is this something the parents created or allowed to happen, or
right.
is this something the child has really, you know, dug in on and the parents do it to keep the peace? And I think a lot of times it's some of both, really. But, you know, for a young child, if it's taking that much effort, and Laura, like you said, it's, you know, we all have our things that we do to keep our children happy and the family happy, but when you're talking that much focus on a daily event like waking up or going to sleep, and it's that much work, and you really have made an effort to have some kind of reasonable routine, and yet it still is taking that much effort, then, you know, maybe some self-regulation issues there. Yeah, right.
Let's zip through a couple of these internal regulation things. And I think the only one that I really want to talk about are kids. And the reason I want to talk about this is because it's happened with two specific little girls on my caseload right now. But kids who aren't able to regulate their hunger, and you can go either way. Kids who are so picky that they never recognize that they're hungry, that they won't eat at all. Those are the kids, you know, who sometimes end up with that failure to thrive diagnosis. They just have such problems eating. And again, sometimes parents believe that it's an underlying medical issue when it could be a sensory issue as far as texture aversions, or they have difficulty swallowing, which would be more like a physiological issue. But again, a lot of times it's not just that they're picky eaters. There is a real underlying sensory issue that makes them have difficulty with feeding. The other extreme is I have two little girls in my caseload like this. They do not recognize when they're full, and so they want to eat all the time. And both the mothers have said to me in the last couple of visits that I've done is she would eat all day long if I let her. And one mom is sharing with me it's like she can't let her mom keep her little girl anytime around mealtime anymore because her mom just keeps feeding her and feeding her and feeding her, and the little girl always throws up because she is not able to say or indicate or, I guess, feel that she's full. And so grandma, being the good, nurturing grandmother that she is, thinks, well, she must be really hungry if she keeps eating it. You know, she's not turning away. She keeps going back to the table. She keeps acting like she wants something else. So the grandmother feeds her, and then she ends up vomiting because she cannot regulate her feeling of fullness. So she can't regulate that hunger, full feeling. And again, that's an underlying sensory problem.
We were talking about this today. I'm not sure I've ever really recognized anyway. Maybe I've had them and I just didn't really recognize it. I would say that far more common is the extreme food aversion kids. And do you think that it's probably the most common sensory? Now, I know two-year-olds are picky eaters. I gave birth to two of them myself. But I'm talking about those kids who are they really only eat a handful of things.
And we've talked about that before. You know,
right, but would you say that's probably the most common sensory processing issue that you see?
I don't know, but you know what? We have somebody that we can ask that next week.
Oh, cool.
our friend, Carrie White, she's got a new last name now. She just got married over the summer. I can't remember her married name. Is it Moore, maybe? Anyway.
Me? Name? No, don't guess.
Well, Carrie is going to be on the show next week, and let's ask her about that, what she thinks and what her educational background and her research tells us might be the most common sensory issues. She might see different ones than we do, but we'll talk about that. I see picky eaters a lot, and I used to do a lot more feeding therapy, but in the last few years when I've really kind of honed my practice with language, I don't see as many kids for feeding as I used to. But, oh, my goodness, doesn't it go hand in hand with kids who have language delays?
Yeah.
And speech issues. It really often does. And, again, sometimes parents don't even recognize that it's a problem. They just kind of go with the, okay, toddlers are picky, or a pediatrician might look at them when they're trying to talk about it and say, all toddlers are picky eaters. And so the mom doesn't say, but you don't understand. He only eats two foods, and that's on a good day. You know,
right.
He really only wants to drink bottles all day long. And, again, a pediatrician might miss that until the kid is darn near three. So picky eaters most of the time are due to an underlying sensory disorder, and you really need to have a speech pathologist or an occupational therapist who specializes in feeding. Look at your kid and help you decide if that's part of the issue.
Really picky eaters, and also, like you alluded to with the bottles, those kids who don't or won't or can't, whichever, fill in the blank, transition from, you know, the pureed baby food consistency to textures, to finger food, to table food, you know.
And that needs to be happening by a year. I mean,
mm-hmm.
In normal feeding development, kids are transitioning to table foods right at about 12 months. So if you have a 15-month or an 18-month-old who is still gagging every time you try to give him something that's not stage 2 baby food, yeah, or mashed potatoes or applesauce or yogurt, or, you know, and sometimes I'll get that with a kid on my caseload, and the mom will say, well, he's kind of picky, and I'll say, what does he eat? And she'll tell me, or I'll say, does he eat table foods? And she'll say, yeah, and then I'll say, well, tell me, what is it? And everything will be, well, he likes yogurt, he likes applesauce, he sometimes he'll eat macaroni and cheese, but only if I mush it up real good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I'll say, do you realize that's not really solid food. Those are still all things that are purees, and sometimes moms don't even think about it like that because they're not buying it in the baby food section. You know, they've expanded to the other aisles in the grocery store, but they're still not very not eating foods with very much texture.
And I don't know about your children, Laura, when they were babies, but mine really made it very clear very early on they wanted what I had. You know,
they're reaching for your plate. Yeah.
Right, which I think is very typical. They're sitting there with you and you're eating your burger and fries or your whatever, chicken breast, and they're thinking, that looks like it has some flavor and some texture. I think I'd like a bite of that. And these kids act like you've stuck something horrible in their mouths, or if they happen to, usually they don't stick it in their mouths, and parents try real hard to get it in there.
Refuse, yeah.
Yeah, and they get it in there, and the kid is grimacing and gagging like you've poisoned me, and you've given a little tiny bite of chicken or a little piece of french fry or whatever, and just that solid consistency sets them off like it's horrible. But I think it's, to me, I'm going with that's the most common red flag. Certainly not a telltale sign that your child has sensory issues, but as far as what I see with kids day in and day out, I can't wait to ask Carrie.
Yeah, and we
what
will
she
ask
said.
Her about that next week.
Okay.
Okay, let's move on to, this is an interesting article that we found on that great website that we've talked about the past few weeks. It's sensory-processing-disorder.com, and this is a child developmental checklist. And these were red flags that may warrant an early intervention referral. And we only have about 20 minutes left on tonight's show. So, Kate, we are going to have to go super fast through these things. But I want to talk about and use age, months of age or years of age on some of these things. And, again, this would be for parents with children under 3, that if your kid is not doing this skill by this age that we talk about, you need to discuss it with your pediatrician, or better yet, go ahead and self-refer and call your state's early intervention program. And every state in the United States, by federal law, has to offer that service to children who are under 3, and you are entitled to a free evaluation of all his developmental skills. That would be looking at his motor skills, communication, social, adaptive, and cognitive skills. So, again, looking at his whole range of development. And if your child is not meeting these thresholds, do not listen to the grandmother who says, he's okay. Do not listen to your neighbor who says, my uncle didn't talk till he was 4, and now he's a doctor. Do not listen to the lady in Walmart who tells you about all of her children who didn't walk till they were 2, and they're just fine now. Don't do that.
Listen to the pediatrician who tells you not to worry. Don't even listen to him or her. Yeah, and I my only thing I'm going to say to slow you down on this, Laura, is I think that these ages are on the high end. Especially,
that's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
So if you're hearing this age and your kid is not doing this by this age, let me tell you what, it should be a big, fat wake-up call for you, because these are very generous ranges. There will hardly be a child who has not achieved these skills by this age that there's not a big developmental problem going on. And you need to perk your ears up and get your phone book out or get on the internet right now and decide that you're going to go ahead and find a professional that can help you help your kid.
And if you're listening, call. Our number is 1-718-766-4332. Okay, Laura.
Well, you know, and one reason we may not be getting callers tonight is because this is not our normal time. Usually we're on Fridays at 1 o'clock, and tonight we have altered our day. And from looking at the statistics, school statistics that I get from Blog Talk Radio, most of our listeners actually listen after the fact. And so they're downloading the show either from iTunes or listening to it from TeachMeToTalk.com. So.
And aren't we planning on doing the same thing next week?
Yeah, next week we're going to be on Thursday.
What, the 30th?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so gross motor-wise, if your child is not rolling by 7 months of age, not pushing up straight on his arms and lifting his head and shoulders by 8 months, gosh, that's really late.
I think they're late, too. I know.
So, again, if you have a kid that's not doing this, we're not exaggerating on these age ranges. There is
right.
a problem. Not sitting independently by 10 months, not crawling by 10 months, not and that crawling or commando crawling, that would be, you know, they look like an army guy. They're moving across the floor on his belly. Gosh, our oldest son did that. And then he jumped up and started to walk. And at that point, I didn't really recognize that as, oh, my goodness, he's going to have some serious coordination problems. But that boy did he, and that's a whole other story. I won't get stuck there because I want to go in with these, with these age ranges. But not pulling to stand by 12 months, not standing alone by 14 months, not walking by 18 months. If I had a 16 or 17 month old that wasn't walking, I don't think I would hold out for that 18 month timeline. You know, that's serious, and you need a physical therapist to assess them to make sure that there's not something. Well, we know there's something going on because, again, not walking by 18 months is a big deal.
That's pretty late. I think we skipped what PTs, physical therapists, call creeping is what I
right.
really have always called crawling, which is up on their hands and knees, the way you think of a baby crawling. That the age they give is 12 months. Again, I think that's old, but certainly by 12 months, if they're not doing it, you should be wondering why and looking for some guidance and some intervention somewhere.
Absolutely. Now, some other gross motor, and again, gross motor means big muscle movements like walking. Other red flags would be walking their hands up their bodies to achieve a standing position. I've seen kids do that. Kids with really low muscle tone do that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They really need that support, so they're going to walk their hands up to help get their little mushy bodies to stand up. Kids that are toe walkers, frequent toe walkers, and don't really put their feet down, that's a red flag. And again, that's a sensory issue most of the time. They get so much more input about where their little bodies are, walking in space. Lots of children who are on the autistic spectrum walk on their toes. That's one of the things that we frequently see. Now, that doesn't mean that if your kid does that, that he's positively autistic, but you are going to want to get that checked out because that is a pretty common thing for kids with autism, and it is on the red flag gross motor checklist.
And I would say there are, I know there of one at least physiological reason that kids can walk on their toes, but 9 times out of 10, it probably is more sensory based than anything else, not physiological. It's not their heel cords being too short.
Right.
It's that they're
yeah.
up on their toes because of that proprioceptive response or input that Laura just referred to. Anyway,
yep.
keep going. We got to get through them.
I know we do. I was just going to say we have one PhD level PT here in town that does send everybody who does think that's the reason that several kids that I've evaluated after her, you know, she's talked about that, and almost all of those children, without fail, all the children that I'm referring to that I've seen after her were all doing it from a sensory perspective. So, again, sometimes professionals aren't even making good judgment calls on that.
Oh, she
okay.
thought it was the heel cord issue?
Oh, yeah. On the fun kid.
Oh.
I'm going to call her and say, hello, did you notice the other things he was doing too?
Did you notice? Yeah, okay, we better not get off on a tangent. Okay, let's keep going.
Yeah. Flapping, I know, okay. All right, and also another gross motor indicator would be any medical diagnosis that would cause them to probably have gross motor delays, and those children, I think, really are very easily identified and referred by their physicians pretty early on. Children with Down syndrome, children that might get a cerebral palsy diagnosis really early. Even kids who have congenital heart conditions often have gross motor delays.
Right.
Okay.
Those they identify. It's those kind of kids who look very typical and
right.
don't have anything obvious that they tend to say, it'll be fine, don't worry. And, of course, every parent in the world wants to hear that. But
and
we're not saying you should worry, but we're saying you should act on it.
Right, and it is funny how parents will almost kind of rally other people to say not to worry, and
mm-hmm.
then they still have that sinking feeling in the pit of their stomach, and I just beg parents to listen to that feeling, because if you have that, more than likely there is something really, really going on, and you need to get it checked out. Okay, here we go, fine motor, and again, fine motor means little muscle activity or smaller smaller muscle, fine motor, that's really, again, going to deal with your fingers, and this would be in your hands. If a child is frequently holding his hands in a fisted position with both hands after 6 months, a kid that can't bring his hands to midline or the center of his body right in front of his chest and belly by 10 months, a kid who can't bang objects together, like take two blocks or two anythings and bang them by 10 months, and again, that's late. That's really on the, isn't that on the test at about 6 months, 6 to 8 months, Kate?
It is mine.
It is mine.
Yep.
Kids who can't clap by 12 months. You have a kid that's older than one that's not clapping. Again, there could be some fine motor issues there. A kid who cannot deliberately and immediately release objects to give them to you by 12 months. These are the kids that are just droppers and throwers. And I don't mean an intentional throw. I mean the kids who accidentally kind of pop it behind their bodies. We've had a girl do that. Got another legal guy that I'm seeing that does that a lot. He's close to two. And he does kind of pitch it behind him accidentally, and he doesn't even mean to. He just cannot. He doesn't have good release control, is what I think OTs call it. Kids who can't tip and hold their bottles by themselves and keep it up while they're sitting up by a year. Kids who are still using a fisted grasp, that would be all their little fingers around a crayon, at 18 months. That one's the only one that I think that age I might kind of agree with, because I see a lot of fisters even after two, but again, probably because they all have fine motor issues.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was a little younger, because I think you're right, because we don't necessarily watch typically developing kids hold a crayon or a marker or a pencil.
Right.
So, but I certainly have seen kids who were 15, 16 months who have a mature grasp, and I always say, I love the way she holds that pencil. Oh, look at that. It's wonderful. Because so many of our even 30-month-old or even 3-year-old children, they've got their whole hand around that marker, and they're pushing on it with dear might, you know, all their might. And it's just like I guess a fisted grasp is the best way to describe it. They're not using their fingers. It's just stuck up in their finger.
Okay, kids who are not using a mature pincer grasp, and again, that's going to be where you take your thumb and your index finger and you pick up something really, really tiny by 18 months. And again, boy, I think that's really old.
Mm-hmm, very.
And then the next two, a kid who can't imitate drawing a vertical line, that would be a line that goes up and down by 24 months. Or a kid that can't snip with scissors by 30 months. And I think that would blow moms away. They would think, No way is he supposed to be able to do scissors at 2.5. And, yeah, typically developing kids can use scissors and be able to at least get a little snip. So many of the kids that I see cannot for the life of them figure out how to put their thumb in one hole and their fingers in the other hole. And again,
right.
That might indicate.
They try and use two hands. Do you have a lot of those?
With the Play-Doh scissors, oh, my goodness. Sometimes I get so I'm frustrated with them that I just say, let's just use the knife.
That's what I was just going to say. Let's get the knife. Yeah, because they're trying with all their might, but they cannot motor plan to get those hands open and closed.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay, let's skip on really quickly. Let's finish up with the sensory stuff, because that's what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks, and we're just going to have to save the rest of these for another show. And
okay.
I promise I'm going to get this list on the website over the next weekend, because I think it's so important. But let's skip on to the sensory one, since that's what we've been talking about the last couple of weeks. If you have a child with these issues, you really should be seeking out an early intervention referral or a developmental therapy referral or for sensory issues, an occupational therapy referral for your kid. If you have even a 2-year-old who is so busy, always on the go, cannot sit for anything, very, very short attention span, he's probably a sensory seeker that we've talked about in the past couple of weeks, and he needs an occupational therapy referral. On the other end.
Let me do the next one.
Go ahead. Oh, this is yours. This is your favorite one to talk about.
often lethargic or low arousal. No, appears to be tired, slow to respond all the time, even after a nap. And I affectionately, because I really love each and every child I work with, but when we're having our in-between therapy session chats on the phone, I always say, a bomb could go off and this kid wouldn't flinch. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I probably shouldn't even say it. But all I mean is, and we know amongst ourselves, that means, whoa, he's a really low arousal child. And it takes so much to really get their attention. And, you know,
right.
we work hard for our money with those kids because we have to ratchet it up in order for
right.
them to even really look at us or act like they recognize that we're there. And those kids, I think, frequently get referred to by their parents as very easy children, you know,
right.
because they do tend to kind of sit there and not really demand much, and they really don't respond to too much, but they're sweet and they're easy, and they get overlooked. Right, they
get
they're
yeah.
as opposed to the I'm so busy I couldn't sit still if my life depended on it. Young children, these kids are, you know, pretty passive, easy children, and it would be easy to overlook. I think it's not until the parents see that, gee, he's not talking, or you know, some other big thing that they're expecting to happen hasn't. Then somebody else points out, he's pretty low arousal, isn't he?
Right.
And
right.
how many moms have you had say to you with the tear in their eye, I just thought he was easy.
I just thought he was good. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
these are second or third or fourth children,
mm-hmm.
and the mom is so relieved not to have a demanding, busy toddler that, again, they have missed really even being concerned until it's really kind of late in the game. I have a little girl that this was just the second week I saw her, and I'm, again, the replacement therapist. She's had another speech pathologist before me, and she wasn't doing too well, so mom got somebody else, me, but she, I kept saying low arousal, and the mom said to me, you know, I've never really called her that or thought about it in that way, but even as an infant and even as a younger toddler, people would ask me all the time if she was sleepy, if she didn't get her nap. Even when she just woke up, she looked like she needed to go back to bed because she just really looked tired. And, again, it's because of that low arousal piece. Okay. We've already talked about this tonight. Kids who are picky eaters, occupational therapists can help you decide that. There are some OTs and some and lots of speech pathologists who specialize in feeding difficulties, so you want to seek out somebody with experience in that. We've talked about these next few over the last few weeks, so I'm going to just zip through this list and tell you if your child has these issues, these are not normal things, and it really does warrant you talking to your pediatrician or, better yet, just making self-control to go ahead and have them evaluated. So children who aren't aware of when they get hurt, you know, like your example of that little boy who touched the light bulb and didn't even cry at the beginning when he was severely burned. Was that burned or
cut,
wasn't he?
Cut of glass on picture frame, yeah.
Yeah. Kids who are afraid of swinging or movement activities. Kids who don't like to be picked up or upside down. Kids who have difficulty learning new activities, like you have to show them how to do a toy a bazillion times before they get it, if at all. Kids who have a hard time calming themselves down. That would be a kid who might, you know, again, have a temper tantrum, not just a little two-minute thing and it's over. These would be kids who can cry an hour and they're still going at it, and nothing you do seems to help them calm down. Kids who appear to be constantly moving around, even while sitting. Sometimes I myself might fall into that category with my legs swinging and constant jiggling. Kids who show poor or no eye contact. Kids who are frequently jumping and purposely falling to the floor or crashing into things. Again, sometimes parents just look at that as he's wild or he's active, or a lot of times they'll say, oh, no, he has ADD. You can't identify ADD in a kid that's not school age. So, again, sensory processing disorder is probably what's going on there. Don't think you're going to get them some Ritalin at 2 and everything's going to be okay. Seeking opportunities to fall without regard to his or her safety. Again, that would be a thrill seeker, a kid who wants to climb up
to the very tippy top of the jungle gym and jump without realizing, oh, no, that may break a bone. Or I want to jump on somebody's back, or I want to jump on all my friends' backs here. You know, kids that really, really are constantly seeking out that that physical contact. Kids who touch everything they see, including other children. Kids who have those floppy bodies, that low muscle tone, like we talked about several weeks ago on the show. Kids who have a very difficult time of transitions between activities and locations. These would be the kids that you have a hard time getting them to go anywhere. And then once you want to leave, boy, you have a hard time getting them to leave too. Kids that are overly upset with a change in routine, that would be like you gave that great example earlier, Kate, about he has to watch XYZ or he's not happy. A kid who absolutely freaks out with toothbrushing, hairbrushing, haircuts. I have moms that still are only cutting their children's nails when they're asleep, even when they're close to three, because that is such a big deal for them. And kids, and we've talked about this in the last several weeks, kids who are really afraid of, aversive to, or will go to any kind of length not to have their hands messy. So those, again, are big red flags with sensory issues that need to be checked out. All right, I think we're about out of time tonight.
I think we are.
You know, next week we have a great show because we're going to have Carrie on. And, again, she's our friend that's an occupational therapist. She is going to talk with us. We're bringing the real expert in about sensory disorders. And she's going to talk with us about treatment modalities that moms might hear about, like the brushing protocol, listening therapy, those things that are a little bit more clinical. And she's going to explain all those to us and talk about when they're indicated for children and recommended for children and when they're appropriate for children. And anybody who has a question that you've been dying to ask an OT, this would be a good night for you to call in next. So next Thursday night, October 30th at 6 o'clock Eastern time.
Sounds great.
All right. I am going to get this whole checklist up on the website, so if anybody's wanting to look at that, that's going to be up hopefully by the end of this weekend. And after we finish the stuff with Carrie at some point, I really, really want us to do the same thing with language, Kate, where we take the big, if your kid is not doing this, you better call a speech pathologist today.
Okay.
So I want us to be sure that we do that in the next couple of weeks because I think that's what we're all about.
I agree.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank
to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.